It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Congress heads to a month-long recess at the end of next week, and their solution to the influx of migrants at the border appears to be at an impasse.
First, the federal government announced today that they're seeking stricter rules for rail cars that transport flammable fuels throughout the United States. The suggested regulations come amid a domestic energy boom, which has seen an increase in train cars carrying hazardous liquids like crude oil and ethanol. That's also led to several high-profile derailments in the U.S. and Canada.
Earlier this month, WPR News reported that rail companies in the state are transferring substantial train loads of volatile Bakken crude oil through 18 Wisconsin counties at an average of 45 times per week. So new regulations could have particular interest here in the state.
Mike Simonson joins us now. He's WPR's reporter in Superior. He initially reported those numbers on crude oil coming through the state. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Let's get into what we're hearing from the Federal Department of Transportation when it comes to these rail cars.
Well, there's a few changes that they're trying to get, and the probably the most dramatic is slowing the trains down to 40 miles per hour. A lot of the critics of the industry say it should be as low as 20 miles per hour, but they're reducing it from 50 to 40 miles per hour. Another big thing is replacing about 100,000 old tankers. Now, the railroads have been upgrading their tankers, upgrading the design, making them safer since 2011. But as you said, the Bakken oil fields are just going crazy with production doubling just in the last couple of years. So they just can't keep up with making enough new cars. So, which brings us to the third thing is that the U.S. government wants full compliance by the railroads, these changes in place within 2 years.
And you mentioned the boom in various kinds of fuel production in Canada, the United States. Is that why we're hearing interest in these regulations right now?
Well, there have been 11 fiery explosions in different communities in the past year, including one in Quebec that took the lives of 47 people, another one in Castleton, North Dakota, which took out part of a small town because this fuel is so volatile. You know, there's a few reasons for it, but one reason is that it has more gases in it, and another is they don't put stabilizer in it that the Texas crude is put into it. So it's really making the headlines, and people now know that these tankers are coming through La Crosse. La Crosse is kind of like Grand Central Station, and it goes across central Wisconsin to Milwaukee and Kenosha counties, or it goes down the western border counties. I think it's a total of 18 Wisconsin counties have this Bakken crude going through. So there is a lot of concern and a lot of publicity, and you know, everybody's kind of looking at tanker cars pretty suspiciously now, especially if it goes through urban or populated areas.
There are a lot of business interests at play here. The companies that are producing the fuel, the rail companies, the people who make the rail cars. What's been some of the response from industry to these proposed regulations?
About a month ago, I was doing a story about the Sandpiper expansion by Enbridge Energy, and they insisted that this fuel is no more volatile than regular crude oil. That was an industry group who came on that, but I think they're backing off on that because every other, including the USDOT, says this is a more volatile fuel. And so the industry says they're going to take a look at it. There's a 90-day comment period, or make it a 60-day comment period for these new rules that the USDOT put out just today. And I guess we'll see what they're doing. The railroads are trying to do things, but you know, this is really an incredible story. The amount of production that's coming out of Bakken and also Alberta has just doubled and tripled. It was they reached a million barrels of oil a day just last month.
Well, you described for us the path that some of this cargo is taking through Wisconsin, and you reported on this based on your open records request. Does the public, for the most part, know what is coming through their area?
I think a lot of the emergency governments, the first responders, know when and where specifically. There are maps that are now going out, but I think communities really want to know, is there a way that it can be rerouted around it? And this USDOT order asks for other routes when possible to get out of populated areas. But it is so explosive, and it is that you cannot, that once it is on fire, you can't put it out any other way except with foam, or you got to let it burn. And that's what happened in Castleton. They just had to let it burn. You couldn't get close enough to fight that fire. So it's, you know, it's got the potential to take out half a town. And if it's going through a downtown area, if it's going through a neighborhood in La Crosse, yes, folks are going to be pretty concerned.
And I gather that when you filed the records request to find out what was coming through Wisconsin and where it was going, rail companies objected to that. So do you know why they did?
Well, they're trying to keep things. They're saying it's a business secret, and they're calling it a homeland security thing so terrorists can't get it. But they're not saying that exact time the trains are going through, and individual state governments, including Wisconsin's emergency management, decided that the public safety far outweighs the interests, the private interest, the industry secrets of the railroads. But yeah, the railroads, in their letters disclosing two emergency governments of each state, had a threat at the end. The last paragraph was, if you do release this, we are going to take legal action against you.
Now, these new rules are coming from the federal government. Have you heard any response from Wisconsin's congressional delegation on these issues?
Yeah, Congressman Ron Kind has been kind of out front in trying to get more money from the feds for more track inspectors. And Congress was successful in getting another $500,000, which is a bit more than a drop in the oil bucket as far as getting people to be inspecting tracks. He says what the DOT wants happening in the next 2 years, the industry's already been moving in that direction. He would like to see more track inspections, and he would also like to see more track replacement. And he would also like to see that stabilizer that I mentioned a little earlier put in this oil so it isn't so volatile. And that would have to happen in Bakken at the oil fields itself before it even hits the rail lines.
You just mentioned the phrase, in the next 2 years for these Department of Transportation regulations. With these rules out today, what happens next? How long would it take to implement them?
Well, it's a 60-day public and rail industry, of course, comment period. And the final rules will come into effect early next year. And then they've got 2 years to meet these.
So we've seen a lot of increased traffic, as you mentioned, of these rail cars carrying this fuel. Are we seeing as much as we're ever going to see, do you think? Or are these numbers going to keep going up?
No, it's a crazy story. I mean, I've been doing the Enbridge Energy. They're throwing around billion-dollar figures for either upgrades for their pipelines or for new pipelines. And the rail system is clogged, literally is clogged with oil. So grain shipments from farms can't make it to ports, or coal shipments to electrical co-ops can't make it there. And the Bakken oil fields, that's only one oil field. It's really just part of the Williston oil field, which is a much larger system in the Dakotas. So, yeah, we're seeing just maybe halfway mark, maybe more. I mean, how much can you carry? And that's what the question is now.
So we're going to see increased pressure for more pipelines and more railroad cars coming through.
Boy, as fast as they can get them, and as fast as they can build them, and as fast as they can get them permitted and regulated.
We'll leave it there, but I'm sure we're going to come back to this. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
That's Mike Simonson. He's WPR's reporter in Superior. Time now for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Last night in Georgia, after a heated race, business executive David Perdue won the runoff in the Republican Senate primary, I should say. He'll be fighting for one of those seats that Republicans need to take control of the U.S. Senate.
And August recess is quickly approaching, but Congress has reached an impasse on crafting a solution to the tens of thousands of young migrants who are being held at the border. Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
Hey, Veronica. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So last night we saw a pretty close race coming out of Georgia in this runoff election between David Perdue and longtime Georgia Congressman Jack Kingston. Tell us how it shook down last night.
Well, it was not supposed to be this close. We are once again learning that, you know, never trust the polls. The thought was that Kingston had a decent lead in this race. He's very well known. He's been a congressman, as you said, for many years and is well known in the state, and was heavily funded by the Chamber of Commerce and other sort of, you know, big Republican establishment groups. But he lost in a very narrow result. He lost to a businessman named David Perdue, who's a former Dollar General CEO and is
and Reebok.
Family member of the former Governor Sonny Perdue, so also a pretty well-known guy.
So why was it so close?
Well, you know, it's close because they're both, you know, well-known candidates, well-known names. There is still in the Republican Party a great deal of dissatisfaction with almost anybody who has spent quality time in Washington. I think you saw Kingston's tenure work against him in this matter because, again, you say I'm from Washington, and particularly in the Republican Party, where the Tea Party wing looks at you and says, "Well, if you've been there, you've done wrong," sort of by definition. Now it becomes David Perdue against another famous name in Georgia, the daughter of former Senator Sam Nunn. Michelle Nunn is a Democratic nominee for a Senate seat that could actually be in play.
Right. This is being watched as a pretty big deal, as is Georgia's a state that could tip control of the Senate one way or the other, depending on who comes out on top, Democrats or Republicans.
Right. Well, and you'd assume that Georgia, you know, deep red state, is going to be represented by Republicans. But this is the first time in a long time that Democrats think they might actually have a shot at that seat. Perdue is a bit of an unknown, and he has been involved in businesses that have downsized and moved jobs overseas. At least that's the allegation that Democrats are going to try and play up as much as possible. So who knows what's possible? Again, I'm not going to watch the polls too closely because I'm not sure I believe them.
So is that just you, Paul, or are other political watchers deciding, you know what, look at Eric Cantor, look at this race, maybe we're not going to play so much into the polls this time around?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have a particular vendetta against polling at this point because I'm tired of it. And I say this, you know, as the politics editor at USA Today, where we spend an awful lot of time doing polls. I think that there's a sort of exhaustion factor in polls. People in the press, we love to do them because they're an instant story. But they don't tell you a whole lot necessarily. After a little while, you've been through them once or twice. Everyone's done another version of the poll. It really doesn't tell you who's going to go out and vote.
But then when the polls are proven wrong, everyone gets to be outraged that the polls were wrong, and then you have another story. Right.
You see how the cycle works.
It keeps going, right. Well, Congress is going to head into a recess, I gather, a month-long recess coming up pretty soon, end of next week. And running up to that recess, it seems as though we are at an impasse. Congress is at an impasse when it comes to passing any kind of deal to deal with the influx of migrants, young migrants at the border. Catch us up to speed on that.
Yes, well, I might take issue with your word of running up to the deadline because, of course, Congress is plodding to their exit. Yeah, the Democrats last night issued their version of the bill in the Senate that would provide $2.7 billion. As I think you and I have discussed before, the Obama administration said, we have this influx of kids. There's somewhere between 40 and 50,000 kids from Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador arriving at our border and basically turning themselves in. And the administration said, we need $3.7 billion to manage this crisis. They're overwhelming the system down there. Well, the Democrats said, well, how about $2.7 billion? And the Republicans are now saying, well, how about maybe something closer to $1.5 billion? But the sticking point here is not the money. The sticking point is going to be the policy change. The administration initially suggested they'd be open to a policy change that would make it easier to deport these kids more quickly, basically send them back where they came from. It's already easy to send people back to Mexico. For these other countries, they basically want to extend that policy. Then the administration backed off and said, well, particularly because a lot of immigration advocates and Democrats were very uncomfortable with the idea of sending these kids back quickly to what could be very dangerous circumstances. So the administration has sort of backed off. The Democrats have said they don't want to do it. And the Republicans are now saying this is the critical component. If we don't get that policy change, we're not going to pass the funding. So we're nowhere, basically, is where we are.
Well, this is not a situation where you can just hit pause and merrily go on your way. I mean, we've got so many kids, as you said, down on the border in detention centers. Something is going to happen. What's going to be the first to give? What do you think?
I don't know. Ask the pollsters. I mean, what I suspect will happen, but it's just a guess, is that Congress will not get this done this week. They will go on recess, and the administration will begin to sort of reprogram money around from various other things. They will start moving things around. They will conclude that possibly the flow of children has slowed because the message has gotten out, don't send your kids north. And then we'll come back in September and maybe find a way to just pass a, you know, maybe $1 billion worth of money just to sort of stretch them through until November.
That's not going to be the policy change Republicans want, it doesn't sound like.
No. I expect can kicking. Kicking the can is what Congress is good at. But I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't know if there's any way they can figure out a way to get a bill passed that does change these policies. What they may be able to do is just start moving more quickly. I suspect Obama is going to say something in the next couple of days that will speed deportations unilaterally, therefore avoiding Congress having to be involved. That's the kind of thing that you expect to see happen when they can't get Congress to move.
Any chance there'll be any work done in August? Is it even legal for Congress to do that?
Well, sure, but why would they? I mean, at that point, they are in by and large, they go back to their districts. They call it the district work period, which we all think is a joke. But they go back to their districts. Theoretically, they meet with constituents, and they go on vacation. They're not going to do anything in August. They'll be back in September to take up any legislation. Now, I will say, staff are still here. There are still meetings going on. They're still, you know, doing some research on hearings or whatever else they may do in September. But no, they're not going to pass any bills.
Well, let's move to Israel now, some foreign policy matters on the table. The U.S. still a staunch supporter of Israel throughout this, and the support here seems to cut across party lines, one of the few things that is right now. Why is U.S. support for Israel so staunch in Congress right now?
You know, the issue in Congress remains, and always remains, that Israel is our strongest ally in the region. Period, end of sentence. They are our strongest ally in the region and have been for, you know, many decades. So Democrats can't alienate their base voters. A lot of, you know, they have a lot of Jewish voters. Let me rephrase that. Jewish voters tend to be Democratic supporters, not always, but frequently. No one is going to vote against them. They have a very powerful lobby. And basically, on both sides of the aisle, they look at Israel as a bastion of our foreign policy. In fact, in this border bill you and I were just discussing, the Democrats stuck in $200 extra million for Israeli air defenses as kind of a way to sweeten the pot to get Republicans on board.
And are there any voices out there right now calling for a more nuanced approach to U.S. support of Israel, or is this something that's it's just sort of monolithic across the board?
Well, I mean, there's always voices calling for nuanced support, and there are some people who would argue that the ban on travel, the ban on travel to Ben-Gurion Airport that the FAA issued yesterday amounts to a rebuke of Israel because it's making, you know, Israel more uncomfortable. It makes travel very, very difficult to and from there. It cuts into tourism, which is, of course, lifeblood for Israel. So you could make the argument that, well, this was the administration trying to very quietly put pressure on Israel to, you know, stop bombing Gaza, essentially. But I don't think that's true. I think they really are concerned about the fact that, particularly in the wake of the airplane that was shot down a week ago in Ukraine, you don't want to send passenger aircraft into areas where there's missiles being fired.
Going to leave it there. Paul, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Veronica. Talk to you soon.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to talk about the latest from Congress.
For many years, along the highways and byways of America, roadside attractions were everywhere, from giant dinosaur sculptures to tiki bars, from aquatic shows to mystery spots. They ran the gamut of the imagination and had us begging our parents to stop the car, take us there.
But in recent decades, many of these attractions have disappeared, a big hit to what was once a huge slice of American culture. But all is not lost. Our next guest is a champion of vintage roadside attractions, past and present. And he's traveled the country documenting the places and people involved. He's coming to Wisconsin to give a photo presentation on these roadside marvels and which ones you can still go and see.
Joining us now is Jeff Kunkel. He's the co-founder of Vintage Roadside. He'll be giving a presentation called American Roadside Attractions this Saturday at the Harley-Davidson Museum in Milwaukee. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to join you.
Well, you've taken on this cool job, this cool mission. You go around searching for and capturing these lost slices of Americana, these roadside attractions. What got you interested in this?
Well, I guess it's kind of like, all of us, we have that memory of being in the car and seeing that great big dinosaur and begging our parents to stop. And then, of course, Dad wouldn't stop. And so you grow up thinking, I wish I could have stopped there. And then when you get a little older and you realize you're driving the car, you can stop everywhere. And so that sort of led to where I am now. And, 8 years ago, my wife and I were on a road trip in central New York, and we were seeing all these old pieces of the past that were gone or closed. And we were asking around, what happened to that place or what used to be there? And no one could really let us know. So we got in the car and just had one of those life moments where we said, maybe we should take some time and let people know what happened to these places. So we came home and quit our jobs and started Vintage Roadside.
Wow, that's quite a story. And now you're going to share it with the world, starting with, I guess, Milwaukee, or at least including Milwaukee on the way. You're going to come and give a presentation. What sorts of things will you be sharing with people?
Well, we have a huge photo archive of vintage images. I'm kind of a photo nerd, so I have a lot of commercial images from the 50s and 60s, and then a big collection of old Kodachrome family road trip slides. So we'll start out with some great images from the past, sort of taking a look at the road trips that people took in the 50s and 60s, and then we'll segue into some of my photography from our last 8 years of road trips.
Did people build their vacation plans around these roadside attractions?
Looking through some of the old slides we have, there are some people that I consider kindred spirits that did stop at every dinosaur or giant thing and take a goofy photo of themselves. So I think there's always been a part of the population that did do that. A lot of times people were just going from point A to point B and would maybe stop once or twice, but I've got collections of people that were truly, they were looking for the odd thing to stop at every time.
Jeff, can you give us a sense of how many of these are still out there and how many we've lost?
Well, the golden age of the roadside attraction for me was really in the 50s and 60s before the interstates came in and sort of siphoned all the traffic off the highways. And that's when, we lost a huge chunk of them. And, there's still quite a few out there, but it takes a little work to find them. But, every now and then somebody still opens a new one and gives it a shot. And those are the people that I personally just love and I want to tell their story. They're the people that didn't get the normal job. They decided to build something weird in their yard and see if they could get people to stop by.
Can you give us a few more examples? We've mentioned just a couple, but what are some of the unique sites, past or present, that you've studied?
Yeah. One of my favorite ones from the past was in Daytona Beach, Florida, and it was called the Beautiful Atomic Tunnel. And so this guy built a gigantic circular fiberglass ring with a dome over the top and then punched in a few porthole windows and then added monkeys, piranhas, and an orchid queen. And so you would stop by and visit the Beautiful Atomic Tunnel. And it was, during the Cold War era, so he was playing up on that. But in reality, he just had a big fiberglass donut in his backyard, and you would stop by and pay a dollar and get your picture taken with the monkey. And he had a great mascot called Happy the Walking Fish, which was this walking fish in spats, and he had a top hat. And You know, that one, that to me was just the genius of that sort of marketing hook. And it's the type of place you stop at and you know that you're probably going to, like, lose your dollar because it's not going to be that amazing. But you go through it and you feel like you're sort of in on the joke. And, you know, you leave with a smile on your face. And, you know, that's, especially for me, the past, that's what it was. It was a little bit of P.T. Barnum. And, you know, you knew you were probably being taken for a ride, but you didn't mind because then you came home and told everybody about how you got to meet Happy the Walking Fish.
Yeah, the Walking Fish sounds awesome, but not all of these things are family friendly, shall we say. There were some kind of naughty mermaid ones, weren't there?
Yeah, there were. You know, that's another thing that we've sort of gotten involved with is researching all of the old mermaid attractions. And in San Diego, there was a cocktail lounge that had mermaid shows behind the bar, and they became quite infamous in the 60s when their midnight show would feature topless mermaid shows. And
you had to peek through a porthole, right?
Yeah, you would see it behind the bar. You know, the bartender would be back there mixing drinks, and here would come a mermaid with no top on. And, you know, I was lucky enough to speak with the owner of the hotel, and he remembers going to visit it when his father owned it when he was only 12 and sneaking in there and thinking it was the coolest thing he'd ever seen.
And we kind of joke around about the goofiness of the mermaids and the walking fish and whatnot, but is there something here? Does this tell us something about American culture?
I think it does. It, you know, everybody's sort of looking for something unusual that takes you out of your everyday life. And, you know, for example, when my wife and I, Kelly, got married, we got married up in central New York. And that afternoon after our wedding, we spent it digging for fossils at petrified creatures. And, you know, it's just something that you're not going to do at home, and you just really feel like I'm on vacation now. I'm getting away from everything, and I'm doing something that I'm just not thinking about, and I'm here in the moment and having a great time. And I think everybody's sort of looking for that, you know, at one point or another.
You chatted with our producer, Chris, before the interview, and you've got a story up your sleeve about someplace called the Clown Motel. Can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, I always like to take my road trips with no real stopping points in mind, and occasionally that will get you in trouble when you end up somewhere in the middle of nowhere at 2 in the morning with nowhere to stay. And so we were driving through Nevada, and we hit this little town called Tonopah. And there was two hotels in town, and one was outrageously expensive and nice. And since it was about 2 in the morning, we thought, well, we'll take our chances on the other one. And it was called the Clown Motel, with a great big giant clown on the sign. And it was a little dated looking, but so we ended up going into the office at about 2:30 in the morning, and it's kind of dusty and musty in there. And we opened the door, and we're met with their collection of several hundred clowns in the office. And so we got a room, and we went up into the room, and our room had a wonderful clown portrait over the bed, which was another nice touch. And then so we got up first thing in the morning, and Kelly, my wife, walked outside, and she came back in and she said, "Did you see what's next to the office?" So I walked out and looked, and right next to the Clown Motel office is a cemetery filled with people who met horrendous fates in mining disasters.
Oh.
So, you know, it's like, here lies so-and-so crushed by an ore cart, or here's someone who died in an explosion. And so a pretty surreal experience out in the Nevada desert. But
so it's a build-your-own horror movie.
Right, you know. But I always look at that as, you know, you get home and you don't really tell anybody how wonderful the chain motel you stayed at was, because they're fine and they're great and they've got everything you need. But it's not really as memorable as, you know, that few hours you spent in the Clown Motel. And, you know, that's what I always point out to people is, you know, a little bit of discomfort or inconvenience usually makes the best stories.
Well, I gather this is going to be one of your first times here in Wisconsin, your first time traveling. You're hoping for suggestions for roadside attractions. What kind of things, and we're going
to
ask our listeners to help out at 800-642-1234, what kind of things do you want them to tell you about?
I would love to hear anything around the Milwaukee area. You know, we've heard that Leon's Frozen Custard is a must-see. And, you know, anything big, giant, neon, old, historic, you know. We just want to see anything we can, and we're so excited to come out for our first time. And, you know, we've seen photos from the exhibit so far, and the exhibit just looks absolutely wonderful.
We're talking with Jeff Kunkel about American roadside attractions, and you can join the conversation, too.
Do you have a memory of a favorite roadside attraction that you visited, or was there one that you always wanted to go to, but maybe your mom and dad wouldn't stop the car? And Jeff said he's planning on doing some traveling around Wisconsin, particularly the Milwaukee areas we're talking about. If there's something in around there, give a vote for that, or maybe somewhere else further in Wisconsin that people might like to know about as they're driving around. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Jeff Kunkel of Vintage Roadside. He's coming to Milwaukee on Friday to give a presentation on American roadside attractions. That's what we're talking about right now.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's the coolest roadside attraction that you've ever been to? Do you search out these places? Have you just come across something that's extra cool, maybe around Milwaukee, maybe elsewhere in the state? What has your family liked, and what do you remember as being especially cool when you were a kid? You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're going to take our first caller now. Deborah is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, I called to tell you about a Babes the Bear. When I grew up in the UP of Michigan, we'd go to Munising. Our camp was in Autrain, and then Munising was the site of the first national park on water, Pictured Rocks National Park. And then between Autrain and Munising was Christmas, Michigan. Everything was themed Christmas. And it was about a mile of Christmas stuff, and then there was Babes the Bear in back of one of the hotels. And we'd always say, can we stop and feed Babes the Bear? And you put a dime in his cage, and soda would drop down to him, and he'd drink the soda. And I feel so bad about it now.
It was a real bear.
But yep, it was a real black bear. And but now he's been long gone. But my son ran out. He's been listening to the show, and he said, tell him about not licked at custard in Door County. He pulled a picture of it that he had taken. Unbeknownst to me, when we were camping in the Peninsula State Park. So I'm not sure where it is, but it's a huge sign, like a neon sign. It says, not licked yet.
Okay, yeah, that sounds kind of familiar, but interesting how, I don't know how quirky these things get with a live bear that drinks soda. Obviously, we feel sorry for the bear, but interesting stuff, though. What do you think about those, Jeff?
Yeah, that's fantastic, because it did remind me there used to be it was an old motor court here in the Portland area out along the river, but they also had a bear out front, and you could stop, and apparently his favorite pop was Orange Crush. And you could buy the bottle of soda for a nickel and hand it to the bear, and he would chug it down, and you were good to go.
I remember a trip as a kid to Florida, hitting some of the Disney World and whatever, and my favorite thing was a roadside alligator park. Uh-huh. A lot of animal-themed and a lot of alligators going on in these Florida attractions, aren't there?
Oh, definitely, yeah. We also do a line of T-shirts that are old, defunct roadside attractions, and one of the first ones we did was Casper's Alligator and Ostrich Farm. They had the alligators, and then they also had the world's only ostrich racetrack at that time. They had little harness carts that they would put behind them like chariots, and they would get out there and race the ostriches for you.
Jeff, tell me they kept the alligators and the ostriches separate.
They did, okay. Although you could go into the gift shop and buy quite a variety of alligator products. So I guess everything was full circle there at that time.
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Katie is with us now in Watertown. Katie, hi.
Hi. Nice to be on the air today.
What did you want to tell us about?
There is a found object metal sculpture art site in Colgate, Wisconsin, which is near Merton, kind of in the Pewaukee area. And I was just driving along one day and saw all these signs pointing towards Sculpture Yard, and I had to stop and check it out. And it was a really cool place, and I really, really enjoyed it.
All right, Katie, thank you so much for that suggestion. Also, there's Dr. Evermore's Forevertron sculpture. That's west of Madison here, Jeff.
Yeah.
I think it'd be right up your alley.
Yeah, Chris was telling us about that, and it sounds amazing.
And we want to make sure that we touch on another one of the, I guess, the highlights of your career tracking down these places is getting together, getting a reunion cobbled together of the cast members of something called the Aquarama Show. What was that?
Yeah, that was at the Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri. There used to be a mermaid show called the Aquarama, and it started in 1964, and it was sort of a theater that you would go in. It had slope seating, and where the screen would be in a theater was a giant wall of glass, and so three times a day they would perform underwater shows. And so we started by finding a brochure for it years ago at an antique show, and we thought, wow, this is really weird. They had mermaids in Missouri. So we turned it into a T-shirt and started researching the history, because we put a little history tag with all of our T-shirts. And so we got an order from a gal in Missouri, and we thought, wow, maybe she had heard of the Aquarama. And about a week later, we get an email from this gal, and she says, hi, my name's Janie. I was the head aquamaid at the Aquarama. Would you like to know more about it? And so that was really the door cracking open to that one. And I spent the next 7 years tracking down all 39 people who had ever worked there. And last summer was the 50th anniversary of their beginning training. So we just thought it would be a perfect time to hold a reunion for them, and everyone that could come was welcome, and they brought their families, and I think about 25 of them were able to come to the lake, and it was just so neat to sit in the back corner of the room and watch these people who hadn't seen each other in 40-plus years see each other again for the first time. And, you know, that's really the thing that I get the most satisfaction from is digging deep behind these and finding the people that were responsible for them or owned them or worked at them, and letting them tell me their stories again. It's usually such a fond memory for them, and it was so long ago. It's just neat to let them know that there are still people that remember what they did and to share that story.
It was a unique line of work. Were they proud of the shows they put on looking back 50 years later?
Yeah, they were extremely proud, you know, and most of them consider it the best time of their lives.
Huh.
And they were usually, you know, they'd start as high school juniors or seniors. And, you know, so here they were in this small town in Missouri at that time and getting to work as mermaids or aqua lads. And, you know, I mean, it sure beats my first job at that age.
Ditto here.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We've got Joe joining us from Madison. Hi, Joe.
Hi, is that me?
Yep, you're up.
Oh, great. Yeah, I was just wanted to mention, I'm not sure if your guest has ever heard of Foamhenge.
Foamhenge,
life-size replica of Stonehenge, made of foam, down in, I think it's in or around Kentucky.
Huh.
I have heard of that. Yeah, I haven't got to visit it yet. Have you been there?
It'll blow your mind. You should check it out.
Well, thank you.
Foamhenge.
It won't really blow your mind, but it's pretty novel. So we got a lot of miles and jokes out of that over the years.
Yeah.
I love it. I've never been to Stonehenge, but maybe I could afford to go to Foamhenge.
Right.
It's the next best thing, yeah.
I don't know. It's pretty lazy, Drew. It's, oh, the stone, it's heavy. Foam, we can carry that as far as we want.
Right. No, I'm a big fan of giant things, you know. Just last week we had a friend in town who actually is a mermaid performer down in Florida, and so I drove her up to Long Beach, Washington to meet Jake the Alligator Man. And conveniently across the street is the world's largest frying pan and the world's largest squirting clam. And so, you know, photo ops ensued there. And, you know, it's great when you sort of get three for the price of one.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Chris on the line in Milwaukee. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a couple of suggestions for you. Of course, there's the Safe House in downtown Milwaukee.
What's that? I don't know that one.
Oh, it's a spy bar, for lack of a better word.
A spy bar?
Yeah. You have to come in, you have to kind of, you go down this dark alley, and you have to do a password, and what you don't know is that you're on a closed-circuit camera, and there are all sorts of oddball things inside in the bar. If you open a door, there's a brick wall.
Huh. So it's like a speakeasy, kind of.
Kind of, yeah.
Okay, and what's your other suggestion, Chris? Yeah.
Cops in Glendale has fabulous white cows out back, full life-size statues of white cows, and I think there's one black cow. And I think the Don Q Inn is in Mauston. They were one of the first theme hotels in the state. And I've never been there. I've seen pictures of it. And I think that would be worth checking out. Prairie Moon Sculpture Garden in Cochrane, Wisconsin. There was a beautiful preservation project done with the Kohler Art Museum. And some guy went out and decided to make some incredible concrete sculptures. And I think they're dinosaurs and bears and then just some wonderful, I don't know, objects.
Huh. Chris, thank,
a better word.
Thanks a lot for those suggestions. Jeff, some of those sound like they'd be right up your alley.
Oh, yeah. I mean, literally, her whole list, I was jotting it down, and she was saying that they all sound fantastic.
And Jesse on Facebook wrote to us and said, along I-94 west of Madison is a series of overly large colored animals at gas stations. There's a purple elephant in DeForest, a large mouse, and a large moose in Black River Falls, and a plethora of these sculptured animals scattered throughout the Wisconsin Dells. So the Dells alone could keep you busy for a long time.
Right. No, that one is sort of ground zero for you know, the roadside. And, yeah, that's way up there on our list.
Jeff, can you give us some inspiration and maybe some tactical planning advice for us to get out and check out some roadside attractions?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, the first thing that we do every time we get in the car is we turn off the cell phone and we actually get out a paper atlas. And we say, we're going to start here and we want to end here. And then you pull out the atlas and you look for all those little back roads that will still get you there at the end of the day. But, you know, take those back roads, take those old highways, and you know, don't have any expectations. Just sort of let whatever comes along come along and be surprised, be happy. Stop at everything you see because there's no guarantee it'll be there next time. And, you know, again, just head out with a little bit of inspiration and be prepared for anything, and you'll have a wonderful trip.
Jeff, thanks so much, and enjoy your visit to Wisconsin.
Yeah, yeah. Hope to see everybody Saturday night at 5 at the museum.
That's Jeff Kunkel. He's the co-founder of Vintage Roadside. And as he mentioned, he's giving a presentation called American Roadside Attractions at the Harley-Davidson Museum in Milwaukee. Amarillo.